You are now tuned in to Preach Like a Girl, the podcast with Reverend Dr. Kimberly Majeski. This is where women's voices in ministry take center stage. Join us as we inspire, challenge, and uplift through real conversations, biblical insights, and stories that empower. Because preaching isn't just for the pulpit, it's for every woman called to speak truth. This is Preach Like a Girl. Let's get into it.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Preach Like a Girl podcast. Today, I'm so excited to have our guest, Dr. Beth Allison Barr, with us. How are you, Beth?
I am great.
Good. We were just talking off stage. We both had a good Easter. The weather's warm. I don't know about you. I have, this is the last week of classes for me, and then it's finals. How about you?
Yeah, well, I'm on sabbatical right now.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
But it is the last 2 weeks of classes here. So you can still feel the excitement in the air of everyone looking forward to being done.
Yes. Yeah. It is the happiest 2 weeks probably on university campuses that exist. You are, for those who don't know, chair of history at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. I was just there on the gorgeous campus. And how long have you been at Baylor?
I've been at Baylor for a really long time. I actually don't want to admit how long I've been here.
Okay.
So I started.
Totally fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Full campus, great school.
Where were you here? How did I miss you?
I was there for the Wesleyan Theological Society.
Oh, okay.
And I brought my son, who's a huge Baylor Bears fan, in basketball particularly. So, and we thought we would get their last game before March Madness, but it was the night before we arrived. So, so that wasn't great, but we got all the swag.
And oh, good.
Bears. Everybody know there's literal living Bears on the campus.
There are.
Yeah.
Yep. They have a really nice setup too.
They do.
They also have their own sort of vacation home that's off campus. That's also extremely nice. So
So the Bears are treated well. Yeah.
They're very well taken care of Bears.
Beth is also a hot commodity, but that's the wrong word. But you have this incredible new book. We loved your first book on biblical womanhood, and now this one, Becoming the Pastor's Wife, is so good. I have so many friends who are reading it, you're a medievalist, but I think for our purposes, what I think so great about your work is everybody has questions about, you know, that space in between Mary Magdalene and Lydia and Syntyche and Euodia and Chloe,
right,
and all the girls who are doing it in the New Testament, and how we get to here.
Right.
And I think your work is so helpful to kind of trace that slippery slope. And what I love that you did in Becoming a Pastor's Wife is give us, you know, examples of women who sort of have the phenomena happen to them where they're remembered in history a different way than they lived or served, and then connect that to more later or contemporary examples within the Southern Baptist Church. So kudos to you. Really, really well done.
Thank you.
And such a gift for the church and for all of us who, you know, care about women's ministry, women's leadership, and moving the ball forward to just, take a look back and to see how we got here. I think it's
right.
So helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why that women are held out of ministry, I think, in many ways, is because we simply don't know that women have always been in ministry.
Right.
And so I think, you know, part of that, the reason it's easier to erase the ministry of women in the biblical world is because we don't know how that ministry continued. And so there's people who are like, hey, you know, nobody actually did this, so we must you know, these women in the biblical world must not have been doing that either, which is a very backwards way of looking at it.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing that's interesting too. Like, you know, we've talked about this, you know, in our tradition, I'm in the Church of God. We're a part of the Wesleyan Holiness family, descended from Methodism. You know, the Methodists did women and then they didn't, and then they did, and then they did in ministry. But we have always, since the late 1800s, I mean, since our beginning, some of our founders and, you know, forerunners were women.
Right.
And even in our tradition and in our Wesleyan Holiness family, because we haven't taught about those distinctives, passed those down, and because in our tradition, you can just be called and filled with the Holy Ghost and become a pastor.
Right.
Churches have become so influenced by conservative evangelicalism until, even though this is our value and our belief, it's completely lost.
Right.
So our numbers of women in pastoral leadership have dwindled across decades.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, the influence of conservative evangelicalism is tremendous, and it's impacting even denominations that have ordained women for a long time. And part of it is because denominations that have ordained women for a long time haven't really done the work to create structures to allow women to thrive in those positions. And so when we see this more conservative theology gaining root, it has been influencing even in these places that have been ordaining women for decades, where it's making it more difficult for women to not only become ordained, but actually to get jobs in the pastorate after they get ordained.
Yeah. Do you know, I was raised in Nashville, Tennessee, which is Southern Baptist hub.
Yep.
And there are lots and lots of, I have lots and lots of dear friends who are Southern Baptists. I know a lot of incredible Christians who are Southern Baptists. When I was in high school, Two Rivers Baptist Church was just down the right down the street, across the street from Opryland. And the youth pastor at that time was a woman.
Really?
Pastor Jerry Sutton was his name, was the pastor of the church.
Mm-hmm.
This was an enormous, you know, multi-thousand person church in Nashville, Tennessee. And he would not fire her because he felt like God had said she's the right person.
Yeah.
She did these pizza parties and would free pizza, and you would come and then their gospel would be given. We lived in Nashville. So, you know, the singer would be Michael W. Smith. And, you know, tons of kids would get saved. And still people in the church were like, well, she can't be doing this because she's a woman.
Right.
That church, all these many years now, is not a Southern Baptist church anymore. It's, you know, they pulled out and pulled away because they had to, couldn't toe the line.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, that's what's happening in the Southern Baptist Convention right now, which I'm actually glad about, that so many churches are being like, okay, then we're just out if you're not going to allow us to support women in ministry. So that at least is somewhat encouraging.
Yeah, I really thought that it was a great awakening beginning when your first book came out. What year was that?
2021.
That was... Because that same spring is when Rick Warren, Saddlebag, like he said he was not going to be a part of Southern Baptist anymore because of that.
Well, he ordained three women.
And then that was the same season that Beth Moore stepped away. So I really thought, well, this is going to be, I mean, I think those were some important nicks into the ceiling, if you will.
Yes, I think they were. And I mean, I honestly think it was a big moment. And in fact, even though the SBC is cracking down on women in ministry, and in fact, their convention this year in 2025, I suspect the law amendment, in fact, I know the law amendment is going to be back on the books. I suspect it'll pass this time.
Yeah.
But you have to also understand that the Southern Baptist Convention has, you know, people have been leaving it. And it is already whittled down. It is now the smallest it has been since I think the 1970s, which is actually pretty significant. And I imagine if the law amendment passes, we're going to see even more. And you can also think like, you know, even this is impacting every aspect of the Southern Baptist Convention. They're in pretty significant financial problems right now. And I mean, not that we should glory about that, but it's just, it's evidence that I actually think that there is starting to be a turn against this very harsh stance on women. So, you know, I feel sorry for them that they have chosen to go this way, but they have chosen to go this way. And so, and I think that more and more people are realizing that their position on women is untenable. It's untenable in scripture. It's untenable in history. And it is going to, it's going to significantly impact the decline of the SBC.
Okay, so let's run it back a little bit and talk about some of these women who are examples. Of course, we have, you know, women in scripture. Then we have, you know, in those early second, third century, we can really begin to see in the text itself sort of a pushback or a restriction against women's leadership. We read in the Fathers, you know, Augustine wants us to become like men so we can go to heaven. Tertullian's telling us, Thecla's, this is a crazy story because she's baptizing herself. And you work a lot with what we begin to see women do is become women religious or take these vows and orders to maintain their celibacy and become abbesses of religious houses. So talk to us. I know I've heard you talk about Milburga. Tell us a little about, she's fascinating.
So, I mean, one of the things I want people to realize is that even though there are restrictions on women in that early part of the church and moving into what we would consider to be the end of antiquity, you think sort of, you know, the fourth and the fifth century and moving in, you know, it's artificial separation into what we call the early medieval world. But we have to realize that those restrictions that we see are because women are in these positions. And women are doing it. And the reason that some of these counselors are like, whoa, what are these women doing serving at the altar is because women are serving at the altar. And so even though we hear these voices of people condemning this, we also have to realize that there were voices of people supporting it too. And that there were many of these, you know, there were many men in these early church communities who were supportive of women serving in these roles. So even though we have this negative evidence that shows that some people were critical, that negative evidence, you know, we have to realize it is also countered by the fact that women are doing this and that women are in these roles. And I would argue that that negative evidence, that those negative voices aren't really getting tons of traction. Because women keep doing this stuff. And in fact, you know, what you were talking about, these early medieval women, as we think about the emergence of what we would consider to be monasticism today. And, you know, I always think, you know, I work with mostly Protestant students at Baylor University or even our Catholic students who think about monasticism in terms that it is today. And they see it as sort of a set apart thing from the rest of clergy, from the rest of lay life. And so when we think about women and men in monastic orders, we often think about them being segregated from the rest of us. And that's just simply not how it worked in the early medieval and even really through the central Middle Ages. And so when you think about these people taking vows to become monastics, what they're doing is they're taking vows to become clergy. There was very little difference between, you know, what we would consider to be secular priests and secular clergy and regular clergy. And regular is monasticism. They follow a rule. So that's what the word regular is from. So there's very little difference between this. And so when we talk about these women moving into these monastic establishments and ruling these monastic establishments, we're talking about women serving as clergy.
Those are clergy positions.
Yes, that's exactly right. And not only just clergy positions, but some of the most significant clerical positions in the European world, in the Western mm-hmm. world. And we also see parallels of this in Eastern Orthodoxy too. It's just that my expertise is the Western world. Sure, sure. And so that's where I mostly hang out. But so, you know, a great example is a woman that I talk about in Becoming the Pastor's Wife, whose name is not so well known, but her name is Milburga. And in one of the reasons why I talk about her is because I want people to realize that there are a whole lot of these women running around out here who are doing these. It's, you know, we hear about Hilda Whitby, who's very important. And then we hear about Hildegard of Bingen. And if we only emphasize those names, it makes it seem like that women are really exceptional in these roles, that there's not very many of them. Right. But that's not the reality. The reality is that we're lazy. And so instead of looking to see what other women are out there, we just keep talking about the same ones.
Right.
Yeah. And so Milburga is one of these many women who in the 7th century becomes an abbess of a monastic establishment in the western part of England. And it's a double monastery, which is our word for it. Essentially, it's a monastic establishment that includes both men and women.
Yeah.
And Milburga was in charge. And, you know, today we're like, oh, well, that means that she wasn't this in charge the same way as men were. There is no evidence to show us that.
Right.
That is us bringing modern assumptions to it. Mm-hmm. All of the evidence we have is that she was serving in the same way that a man would have served in that role. Mm-hmm. We know she was ordained. We know that she provided, you know, part of her charge was the spiritual care, as well as the practical, the legal, the economic care over this area. And she was very successful. In fact, she expanded the monastery's reach and was so popular that when her monastery went into decline about a century after her death, and some male monastics came and tried to like rebuild it, they didn't really get any traction until they rediscovered Milburga's relics. And they had to use Milburga's name in order to start building this monastery back up, which I think just shows how significant a figure she was.
Yeah, it's not unlike for me when I read these examples that you talk about and others, you know, it's not unlike the network that Paul linked into in terms of women who had, you know, position, prominence in their communities. These women in the medieval period, I mean, these are women who are well networked. They have... Yes. Resources often come from, you know, wealthy families mm-hmm. or have been held in esteem because of their piety or devotion. And because of that, they're able to get measures passed or at least, you know, keep things going where you might not expect that particular thing would have been allowed or, you know, been able to continue in practice.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we are surprised when we learn about women who were serving in the same types of roles as men. But actually what church history shows us is that from, you know, the biblical world, I mean, I know you know this, that all of the things that men are doing in the Bible and leadership, women are doing too. You know, you can think about Mary and Martha. And Martha, we know the word that's used to describe Martha's ministry is actually not housework. She is doing the work of a deacon. That's the ministry. She's doing the word that's used to describe her ministry is the same word that's used to describe Paul's ministry.
Yes.
And, you know, the only reason we think she's doing something different is because we have brought these assumptions that women can't be in these leadership roles. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the biblical text shows us. And that's also not what the historical text shows us. You know, I mean, another good example, I didn't talk about her in Becoming the Pastor. I talked about her briefly in The Making of Biblical Womanhood, but it is St. Bridget of Ireland. And I love St. Bridget of Ireland. I hope to actually do more work with her. But she is a of course, the contemporary of Patrick. She's actually younger than Patrick. And she has this hysterical story where she talks about how she listened to one of, do you know this? I don't know if you know the story, but she listened to one of Patrick's sermons. And she actually fell asleep during the sermon. And God like came to her and told her in the sermon that she was actually going to, that she could do the same thing as Patrick. She actually didn't need to listen to him because she was called to do the same thing. And it's this amazing story. And, you know, people denigrate Bridget's ordination because in some ways she was sort of accidentally ordained. The priest read the wrong rites over her. And so instead of ordaining her simply as a essentially a deacon, she was ordained as a bishop. And he was like, but it stands. And people are like, oh my gosh, you know, she wasn't really ordained. And I'm like, do you know that St. Patrick actually ordained himself?
Yeah.
No one actually ordained him. Yeah. I mean, if you think about, you know, why do we think Patrick is more of an established figure in the church when he actually has less credentials than St. Bridget does? And so, I mean, it's those biases we carry to looking at these women.
It's those biases. And I mean, I will tell you now, even in traditions where women are ordained and celebrated as clergy, it is those biases. It, you know, I have students and I, as women, you have to say, you know, these churches and congregations are more normalized to having a young man come and fill this position than they are you. And so sometimes, more often than not, that is going to win out just because that's what they've seen modeled. That's what they understand. And it will have nothing to do with your competency, your credentials, your skill, your ability, any of those things.
It's absolutely true. Yeah. And so discouraging, but at the same time, it's also something that doesn't take that long to change. And, you know, once people hear women preach, and they get accustomed to hearing women preach, then they're like, why did I ever think women couldn't preach?
Right. That's right.
Which is why people in conservative circles are so afraid of women like Beth Moore.
Right. For sure.
Yeah. Because once you hear Beth Moore preach, you can't unhear it.
You can't unhear it. And you can't unacknowledge that she's gifted and called and and bring it down the house.
Exactly.
Talk to us about, I love this, your intention with this, about how ordination gets replaced by marriage, the twofer.
You know, so when I first was conceiving of this book, I kind of two minds with it. The historian in me, I was like, if I'm going to do another book, I want to tackle women's ordination. But sort of the more popular call was like, Beth, we want you to write a book on the pastor's wife. And I was like, I don't really want to write a memoir on the pastor's wife. I was like, I don't, as a historian, that doesn't interest me. And it wasn't until I got into some of the research, I was reading a book by one of my colleagues at Baylor, by Betsy Flowers, and she wrote this great book called Into the Pulpit, Southern Baptist Women in the Post-World War II Era. And in it, she describes how some of the most vocal opponents to women's ordination in the Southern Baptist world in the 1970s were pastors' wives. And that struck me as fascinating because I was like, why? Why are pastors' wives so against other women serving in different types of ministry? And so that was when I was like, okay, this, there might be something here. And that, of course, is what became the book. But I began to trace this, you know, follow this trail of evidence of how, what does the rise of the pastor's wife role have to do with women's ordination? And what I found is that as we moved into the 20th century, that women's ordination began to be seen as a threat to the male ministry model, which in the post-World War II era became especially sort of like, we've got to keep men in the jobs. It has to do with the post-World War II economy, all sorts of different things going on. And so the way that, and so what we began to see is we began to see the ideal model for women's ministry being remade in the supportive spouse. That the best way that yes, of course, God calls women to ministry, but God calls women to a different type of ministry than men. He calls women to a ministry that support and enhances male pastoral power. Yeah. And so the pastor's wife became really the ideal of biblical womanhood. Mm-hmm. Kate Bowler writes that she was the safest ministry position, where women could use their gifts, mm-hmm. but they used them in a way where they were still safely underneath male power.
Yep.
And so what we see, and you know, as I said, this totally parallels the evidence. We begin to see this rise in literature for pastors' wives, talking about this ideal role. And in many of these books, it actually villainizes ordained women, and talks about them as being sinful, et cetera, you know, sort of like, and valorizes the pastor's wife role. We also see the rise of these educational units within seminaries, specifically to train women in ministry as being wives.
Yeah.
And so you can think about Dorothy Patterson's model. You can think about at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, where Al Mohler is president, and they came up with the Seminary Wives Institute. And so it became up with this parallel educational model in which women are trained for ministry, but it is a very particular, it is a ministry that is supportive and underneath male authority.
Yeah.
So the pastor's wife became the answer to how you can say you support women in ministry and you can keep women using women's gifts, but in a way that it doesn't threaten male power. And also where you cannot pay them.
You don't just pay two salaries. That's the thing. That's what I mean, the twofer. Because yep. you'll play the piano and do the kids ministry. And then even preach
sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, depending on what denomination you're in. Many pastors' wives actually serve sort of as co-pastors.
Yes.
But, you know, the kicker is that their position is dependent upon their husband.
Right.
So it's, you know, you see this all the time in places where you hear of a male pastor whose wife serves with him. And I'm trying to think of the Australian couple whose name is the Hillsong.
The Hillsong couple.
Yeah. Bobby and I can't, anyway, but this happened to them where he got fired and then she was forced to resign also, even though technically they held different positions in the church as pastors, but her position was dependent upon his job.
Yeah.
And that's what the pastor's wife role is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then tell us about what happened in Kansas City in 1984.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of I would say that's the big story of the podcast that goes alongside in some ways, the Becoming the Pastor's Wife, which is All the Buried Women.
Yes. Your podcast, All the Buried Women. Like, how did I not think of that title before you? That is the best title. Congratulations.
Well,
brilliant. Loving the podcast too. But yes, okay, tell us about
that. That was my co-host, Savannah Locke. Because she went to the archives with me when we were sort of trying to envision this, and she was going through and she was just like, there's all these women who are just buried in here. And that kind of grew. And her original title was, she wanted to do it, Buried Women Still Sing. And that actually comes through in our second episode. It's a great, but yeah.
My course right now on women in church history is listening to your podcast.
Like, it's fun.
It's the online syllabus for them to listen to. So,
well, okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Tell us about it. Tell us about 1984.
Yeah. So 1984 was the turning point in the Southern Baptist Convention. And, you know, you have to imagine, I know people who are outside the Southern Baptist world, they're like, why should we care about Southern Baptists? And I'm like, well, because they are the largest Protestant denomination in North America.
And as they go, I feel like so goes all of evangelicalism, and then other denominations follow.
That's exactly right. They are so powerful. And in the early 2000s, there was more than 16 million of them. Now it's down to under 13 million, you know, with this decline. But nonetheless, they were on the rise in the 1980s. And part of this was also in the late 1970s, there began what we call the conservative resurgence. And the conservative resurgence was a group of fundamentalists within the Southern Baptist Convention who decided that the Southern Baptist Convention was becoming too liberal, partially because it was ordaining women. And I know people are like, what? Southern Baptist women were ordained? Yes, they were. And anyway, and so this was an attempt to turn back that clock on women's ordination. They tied it to biblical inerrancy. I actually argue that it really wasn't about biblical inerrancy, that it was always about gender. There's differences of opinion on that, and that's fine. But I think gender was always an underlying reason for this.
In your book, it's a faulty reading of Eden and the fall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and anyway, that's another whole thing. They came up with all of these biblical reasons, and most of those biblical reasons now have been shown to be biblically unsound. So you can think about the eternal subordination of the Son. You can think about the reading in Genesis where they tried to say that women, that the sin of Eve was desiring power over her husband. And so all of those things they've had to step back on because they are biblically unsound. And so it's like, well, why then is the theology that you built on these still so prominent? Because it was built on biblically unsound arguments.
Right.
But anyway, nonetheless, but in 1984, it was the moment in which the Southern Baptist Convention introduced a resolution. And resolutions aren't binding, but they are often show the direction that the convention is leaning. And that was very true for what happened in 1984. And the resolution was that women could not be pastors because of the sin of Eve.
Right.
That essentially women were more sinful than men.
Right.
And therefore were deemed unworthy of being leaders in the eyes of God. I just want you to think about that. Playing there. And, you know, especially for people who argue that grace covers all sins, to then argue that a sin of a woman eternally condemned all women to be unable to serve in leadership positions. But that's exactly what the Southern Baptist Convention said in 1984. Wow. And it set off a chain reaction that is going to lead to eventually the Southern Baptist Convention rewriting the Baptist faith and message in the 1990s through several steps to finally argue in 2000 that God created complementary and separate roles for women and men, and that women are called to the household, to taking care of the kids and the home. Men are called to essentially the public sphere, and that only men can be pastors.
Right.
So,
I just think of all the implications of a mm-hmm. theology like that. I know that what you kind of tie at the end of your book is into all of the sex trafficking and assault allegations that have been a part of their stories. But just a theology that would say one of God's children is inherently inferior to the other.
Yes.
Like when you start with that, you set yourself up for abuse.
That's exactly right.
I remember in the early 2000s, they called all these women, because a lot of the women who were serving in pastorate, it was overseas.
Yes.
And they called them back, you know, from China and around the world, you know, where no one else wanted to go. And to think about all the people sort of left hanging in the wake of that.
Oh, it was horrific. One of my good friends, she was a friend of my family, and she's about 13 years older than me. And she was actually a missionary overseas as a single woman serving in China. When the Southern Baptist faith and message came down, and she was told that she had to sign it, and she eventually ended up just leaving the Southern Baptist Convention over it. And I mean, her story is just absolutely horrific. And, you know, for a group who claims that their primary goal of cooperation is to further the gospel, the damage that they have done to the gospel is is in, I don't know if we can ever understand fully how much damage they have done to the gospel by saying that God, by limiting God and limiting how God uses women and limiting women's gifts. You know, I mean, one of my challenges in writing Becoming the Pastor's Wife was that it's not a takedown of the pastor's wife role. I mean, I'm a pastor's wife. And I still am a pastor's wife, and I'm happy with that role. What happened with the pastor's wife role is that it became the only role, the primary role. Right. That this is the model of, if you are called to ministry, mm-hmm. you are probably called to marry a pastor if you're really lucky, mm-hmm. or you're called to one of these subordinate type of positions.
Right.
But it essentially says that, you know, that all women's callings are to be these subordinate roles, which means that it argues against, and it is used as a weapon against, women called to pastoral roles, and women called to missionary roles and evangelism roles, and women called to ministry whose husbands are not called to ministry, absolutely. Or women who are not married. And don't want to be married.
Yeah.
It denigrates all of those roles of women.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. It's not what the pastor's wife role is. It is how the pastor's wife role has been weaponized.
That's right. And we're so grateful to you for your good work, because I think that it gives us some examples to push back on and say, this is not how it's always happened, you know, and women did teach and lead men, and look at this example, and it helps us have a place of insight, and I think resonance with our own calling, and a place where we can go to kind of find that, you know, this isn't just a new sort of idea of liberalism, feminism. Right. This goes all the way back to the ancient text.
It does indeed.
And it's the interpretations and the way that it's been applied in certain contexts that's what is faulty.
That's exactly right.
We want everybody to check out All the Buried Women. Phenomenal.
You
want to get Becoming the Pastor's Wife. It's so good. Like I said, I have so many friends that are reading it. Like I didn't tell them to. Like, they're like, did you read this? I'm like, yes, yes. So I'm so grateful for your work. We have just a few questions as we wrap up today that we like to ask our guests. Is there, Beth, if you think about, and I know you hang out in the Middle Ages, but if you think about a personality in the scripture that you sort of most identify with, who would that be and why?
So it probably would be Martha, than Mary and Martha fame, but not because of what Martha is thought to be today, which is sort of, you know, this hostess with the mostess. Mm-hmm. But it is this behind the scenes ministry work that Martha clearly was doing and was so significant to the ministry of Jesus. And so I would say that, and also just the fact that, you know, Martha's kind of a no-nonsense person, and I really am sort of a no-nonsense personality. I mean, I totally could see myself going up to Jesus and being like, tell my sister to start working.
Yeah. Well, 100%.
Yeah.
One of the things we also like to add is there a ministry leader or pastor, a female, that has sort of been an inspiration to you, or someone that has mentored you, or maybe it's someone that you've studied that you kind of hold in esteem and always sort of lean back on?
Yeah, well, if we talk about modern women, I just have to say Beth Moore. She's actually become a friend of mine through all of this. And she continues, I think, you know, Beth Moore is a prime example of how women always do the work of God. Women always do what God has called them, regardless of the limitations placed upon them. And, you know, the things that she endured to live out her calling is just absolutely incredible. And yet she still continues to live out her calling. And so I find that so inspirational. And she's also very willing to admit when she got things wrong. And so I just absolutely love that about her.
Yeah, I love her too. I'd read her memoir
Yes.
Years. Yeah. I mean, wow. What a gift that she shared that story with us. You know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And a word of encouragement to women called to ministry, women preparing for leadership in this era that you might have.
God has always used women. God has always used women in the same ways as men. There is plenty of biblical and historical evidence. And if somebody tells you that God doesn't call women, ask them why they think that. And, you know, I've just decided that we need to stop being on the defensive all the time, because it is for the people who argue that women can't be on these roles. They're the ones who need to be on the defensive. Mm-hmm. They need to defend why they think that. Because I guarantee you, if you actually break it down historically and biblically, they are going to at least begin to question why they believe that. So stop being on the defensive, because you are doing what God has always called women to do.
Yeah, I love that. I heard you say that in Wheaton and thought that was brilliant. Yeah, ask them why they think that, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Dr. Beth Allison Barr, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. We appreciate your work and your scholarship and everything that you do to help build a better world. So thank you. God bless you. And I'll see you again soon somewhere down the road.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll link Beth's book below and her podcast so you can connect with those resources. But we hope you have a blessed day and feel encouraged to follow and answer your call. See you next time.
That's a wrap on this episode of Preach Like a Girl. We hope you're feeling inspired, empowered, and ready to walk boldly in your calling. If you loved today's conversation, be sure to subscribe and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Keep preaching, keep leading, and keep showing up, because your voice matters. Until next time, this is Preach Like a Girl.